Well, the Magna Carta is generally regarded as the beginning of human rights, democracy, and justice in the British system of government and judiciary. I'm sure you all know about the Magna Carta, don't you? With wicked King John oppressing his people. And so a group of his noble barons prevail upon him to sign into being the basic rights that we enjoy today. For example, habeas corpus, the principle that you cannot be imprisoned without a fair trial. The king, the government now, cannot just lock you up and take your stuff if they fancy it. John had to admit, as he signed the Magna Carta, that the law of the land was greater than he was. These are vital constitutional principles which defend us ordinary folk today from tyranny and injustice. These principles were brought at a price over history. We must thank God for them and seek to uphold them. Nobody would be more surprised at the way history has developed than those noble barons in the first place, let alone John himself, who signed the Magna Carta. Surprise, surprise, they didn't go on to found Amnesty International or the UN Convention on Human Rights. They were a load of thugs and crooks, almost to a man. The rights which they actually enshrined in the Magna Carta were never meant to apply to common people like us. There's hardly a single person in this room who would have benefited from the Magna Carta at the time. The Magna Carta was written for the free men, the barons, like them. The whole thing, in the first place, was a political exercise in asserting their own power and wealth, but making it look good. And of course, the Magna Carta was ignored by most of the kings who followed. Yet out of this exercise in blatant self-interest, by the kindness and the wonder of God's grace, we find ourselves now in our system today. It might be far from perfect, but it's immeasurably better than it could be, isn't it? For all their faults and failings, we're governed by laws and courts which at least try to be based on fairness and justice. Give me 2006 over 1215 any day. And why is it a good thing that righteousness and fairness are written into our constitution to protect us? It's necessary because we are all wicked and sinful people and we need to be protected from each other. Now, in this next instalment of our murder mystery, we turn our attention to a whole set of people, the crooks in the courtroom. We're going to see the role that legal injustice played in the case of the murdered Messiah. It was an act of judicial murder. The system should have protected Jesus, but it did not. It was carried out under a system in its own day that was meant to defend justice and right. Yet a system is only as good as the people who operate it. And where people are determined to act in self-interest, the best system in the world will not stop them. And of course, our story tonight is once again not a mere historical exercise, for it reveals the self-interested motives which are found in every human heart, including our own. Now we're going to look at three sets of crooks in the courtroom tonight. First of all, the Jewish leaders. Their role was one of hypocritical self-justification. Now they had, of course, their own legal process. The other Gospels tell us that there were a number of different hearings under different Jewish authorities. They sort of batted Jesus between the priests and the Sanhedrin and so on. Luke provides, in his Gospel, just a summary of that in verses 66 to 67. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together and Jesus was led before them. If you are the Christ, they said, tell us. And they're essentially opening the possibility of a religious charge of blasphemy, inviting Christ to claim to be the Messiah in front of them. And it could have led to an interesting legal argument if he had denied it. But he didn't. Because Jesus, to all intents and purposes, pleads guilty to the charge. Verse 68. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God. They all asked, are you then the Son of God? He replied, you are right in saying I am. Then they said, why do we need any more testimony? We've heard it from his own lips. So there you have it. Jesus makes a rope for his own neck. Now, we might not take blasphemy seriously these days, but in that day and age, everyone knew you couldn't go around saying outrageous things like this. Not only did it effectively misuse your name, God's name, to say that you were his son, it risked a disaster for the whole nation. It was a tinderbox of political discontent at this time. The people might rebel against the Romans, and if they did that, the next thing they'd know, there'd be a legion parked on the temple lawn. It's completely understandable that something had to be done by the authorities to prevent imposters from saying such outrageous things and causing a crisis like that. Such preposterous claims could not be allowed to go unchecked, could they? Unless, of course, Jesus was not an imposter. Unless his claims were actually true. But of course, by this point in proceedings, the truth is not the issue. And Jesus himself knew it. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you would not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. And there was the bottom line for the leaders of the people. They were angry, they were jealous, they were afraid. There was a result they felt needed to be achieved. There was a status quo that needed to be maintained. And the matter, as incidental as the actual truth, was not to be allowed to stand in the way of it. So this trial was fixed from the start. But if so, why bother with a trial at all? Well, partly it was a pragmatic necessity. The goal was not merely to get rid of Jesus. It was to destroy his credibility and maintain theirs. A secret murder, drop him in a lake somewhere, could not be guaranteed to do that. It might turn him into a martyr. And a public summary execution might explode the whole situation. So a veneer of legitimacy needed to be maintained. A pretense at habeas corpus, if you like. But I'm sure there was more to it than that. It does us no good at all to portray these leaders as totally cynical and corrupt. For then we would say, oh, well, I'm not totally cynical and corrupt, and we would get ourselves off the hook. History shows that very rarely is anybody totally and utterly cynical and corrupt in what they do. I'm sure that in the mix of motives amongst them, there were plenty of the Jewish leaders who genuinely believed that to get rid of Jesus was the necessary, right, and proper thing to do for the good of their nation. The trial was not just propaganda to maintain their own position, though it was in part that. It was an exercise in assuaging their own consciences, too. They needed to persuade themselves, at least the tender members of their group, that they were doing right, after all. They needed to be able to believe their own propaganda, at least to some extent. Remember, these Pharisees were outwardly some of the most consistently upright people who have ever walked this planet. Experience of human character shows that very few people can maintain that sort of outside outward display as purely an act. Perhaps a few of them were utterly cynical, but most, I'm sure, were not. They believed something in what they were doing. They needed the trial to justify themselves to themselves, in other words, to be sure that what they were doing was the right thing. Some of the most hideous crimes ever committed were committed by those who genuinely believed it was right to do it. In a book about 10 years ago, I think it was, a journalist travelled the world and interviewed some of the most notorious individuals then living, the 10 most evil men, I think it's called. His research included going to the jungles of Southeast Asia to interview the then dying Pol Pot, and to Saudi Arabia to interview Idi Amin, who had ravaged Uganda. And it's interesting that in every case, he found these world's most evil men were unshakably confident that their slaughter and tyranny was no crime at all, but necessary for the good of their people. They in fact felt a sense of self-righteous indignation that they had been condemned for doing what was right for their people. And when the Messiah was murdered, all sorts were implicated. But the people it took to really make it happen were those who genuinely believed they were doing the right thing. Does that let them off the hook? Well, it is interesting that Peter acknowledges that they genuinely didn't know the full implications of what they were doing. In Acts chapter 3, verse 17, he suggests that in some senses or other, that does soften the condemnation upon them. Acts chapter 3, verse 17, "Now, brothers, I know you acted in ignorance, as did your leaders." Peter admits that these Jewish leaders didn't fully understand who Jesus was when they got rid of him. But even if ignorance is a mitigating factor, it's not an excuse. For they may genuinely have believed that Jesus was not the Messiah, but they only believed that because they'd chosen to reject him in the face of evidence that was there before their eyes. It was a culpable ignorance, in other words. They didn't know who he was, but it was their fault. They hadn't perceived who he was. Do you see? And that's a salutary warning to all of us who have strong convictions. We're confident we're doing the right thing. But have we truly allowed the light of God to shine into our hearts and allowed his words to shape what we believe is the right thing? Or have we just assumed that we already know what is good and right? What kind of person would a first century Pharisee be today? I suspect a fair few of them would naturally gravitate to a clear Bible-preaching church, wouldn't they? Well, the Jewish authorities may have satisfied themselves that they were in the right, but they didn't want to be seen to be the ones who actually did the deed. Far better to let the hated Romans do that and take any residual blame that may accrue. What's more, only the Romans could impose the sentence that they wanted, which was crucifixion. So the kangaroo court bounces down the road to Pontius Pilate, the Roman governor. Verse 1. Of chapter 23. "The whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate, and they began to accuse him, saying, 'We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king.'" Notice the change of tack. The charges have blamed. It had been a blasphemy. The charges have changed, haven't they? Back in the religious Jewish court, it was blasphemy. Now, all of a sudden, we find the issue is political insurrection. Opposing payment of taxes to Caesar, that's a lie. Jesus never said that. In fact, he said you should pay it. And that he claims to be Christ, a king. They're saying things now which are rather more pertinent to the interests of Rome, aren't they? Now, at first glance, as we read this story, you might be tempted to breathe a sigh of relief, because it seems that Pontius Pilate actually has read the Magna Carta and believes in habeas corpus. Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Yes, it is, as you say," Jesus replied. And, of course, Pilate clearly understands the irony, the fact that Jesus is not claiming to be a literal king, but a spiritual king. This is not a religious matter. This is a religious matter, not political insurrection. Pilate understands this. And therefore, he says, it's not a matter for this court. Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." And at this point, Pontius Pilate sounds like he could almost be, British, couldn't he, in his fair play and uprightness. He could umpire cricket in his spare time, couldn't he, and so on. Alas, as we read on, such impressions will evaporate. Because although Pilate knew what his duty was, he knew what was right. Romans had generally a high standard of justice in the courts, we find that in the end, his actions were determined not by what was right, but by self-preservation. His main priority in being governor today was that he would still be governor tomorrow. That's what really counted for him. Now, Pilate at this point is caught between various pressures, you see. There are the demands of these Jewish authorities, whom he despised and hated and wanted to get one over, but whom he had to appease, because he depended on them in order to keep that part of the country quiet. At the other end of the scale, he had the concerns that the crowds might riot if he did get rid of Jesus. Because at this point, he's assuming, quite naturally, that the crowds who were praising Jesus a few days ago will still be on his side. We also know from external historical sources a bit about Pilate. He was a weak corrupt man. But at this point as well, he was under severe pressure from the boss back home in Rome. Imperial eyes were watching him. His governorship was being questioned. His neck was already on the line. We have letters and so on saying, this Pontius Pilate, you know, can he be trusted? He's not a competent governor. One more foul up, and Pilate was on the next boat back to Rome. And he knew it. What's more, there were other pressures too. Matthew tells us that even his wife was in on the action. Now, somewhere among all these other pressures was this little thing called his conscience, his duty, any sense of justice he might have had. And that was still bleating away in the corner. Do what's right. You know what's right. You should do it. But it's no contest. Between these different pressures, the main priority that emerges from it all is, Pilate, save your own skin. So we find him ducking and diving to avoid taking the final responsibility for the decision. First, he finds an excuse to pass the buck to someone else, verse 7. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at the time. But Herod sent him back. So Pilate offers a compromise measure, which he hopes will appease everyone. Verse 16, therefore I will punish him and release him. If he'd done nothing wrong, why punish him at all? But that might just quieten everything down. It satisfies no one. Last tack, last pathetic attempt to pass the buck. Appeal to the crowds, democracy and all that. We all know that if you hand decisions over to the good-hearted people of the land, they will always come to the right conclusions, won't they? Pilate appealed to them again, but they kept shouting, crucify him, crucify him. And you can see Pilate thinking, these people are crazy. Last week they worshipped him, now they want him dead. They prefer to release a murderer. What on earth induced me to take the job in this wretched place? And you can see the sweat on Pilate's brow, the walls closing in on him. He's going to have to take a decision himself. He's going to have to take responsibility. You could almost feel sorry for him, couldn't you? But don't feel sorry for Pontius Pilate, will you? Pilate is a classic weak and wicked man under pressure. And the verdicts of other sources of history tell us that. He was a vile political schemer. He may have play-acted at being a just and noble governor, but when the chips were down, it was number one skin that counted. Pilate knew what was right, but he did what was wrong in order to preserve himself and his own position. John records those telling words, the ones which tip the balance. The crowd say, if you let this man go, you are no friend of Caesar. And at that, conscience and duty shut up shop and go home. With loud shouts, they insistently demanded that he be crucified, and their shouts prevailed. So Pilate decided to grant their demand. He released the man who had been thrown into prison for insurrection and murder, the one they asked for, and surrendered Jesus to their will. And we must not justify Pilate, but dare we judge him either? For most of the time, most of us live in circumstances where our own interests happen to coincide with what is right? Aren't we fortunate to be in a system where it's normally to our benefit to do what is right? The real test comes when your self-interest and your duty diverge. When it really costs us to stand up for what is truth, what is righteous. Until we've actually faced that situation ourselves, we would be unwise to feel too superior about Pontius Pilate. We should treat him as a mirror for our own souls, shouldn't we? Well, we've seen the self-justification of the leaders then. We've seen the self-preservation of the weak and cowardly governor. What is the final contestant in our beauty parade? The final contestant is self-satisfaction. The self-satisfaction of King Herod. Remember in verse 7 that Pilate sent Jesus off to Herod, who was over Jesus' jurisdiction in Galilee. Now, Herod is a confusingly common name in the Bible. The Herods as a whole were puppet rulers installed by the Romans over various parts of Palestine to help divide and conquer a rebellious people. The granddaddy of all of them was Herod the Great. He was the one who killed all the boys at the first Christmas in the attempt to try and get Jesus. What a cruel and hideous thing to do, but they shouldn't take it personally. Herod was a paranoid despot who hated everybody. He executed several of his own sons, including one from his own deathbed a few days before he died, because he thought they had conspired against him. That was the sort of guy he was. And the rest tended to follow in in his footsteps. So later on in the Bible, in Acts, we find his grandson, Herod Agrippa. Herod Agrippa kills the Apostle James in Acts chapter 12, and then comes to a suitably gruesome end himself. But this is a Herod in the middle. This is the Herod who had done for John the Baptist, Herod Antipas, the one for whom Salome danced and so on. For the Pharisees, Jesus was a challenge, you see. For Pilate, Jesus was a problem. As far as Herod was concerned, Jesus was entertainment. And for all we know about Herod Antipas, he loved a bit of entertainment, didn't he? When Herod saw Jesus, verse 8, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he'd been wanting to see him. From what he'd heard about him, he hoped to see him perform some miracle. He plied him with questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. Herod is curious, you see. He prods and he pokes Jesus. He wants to see what will happen. But he's not concerned about the real issues. This is simply an opportunity for some fun at Jesus' expense. And when Jesus won't play ball, well, Herod gets bored. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. And I think we can see in Herod a sort of self-satisfied, smug flippancy about things that really matter. "Please don't class me with those squealing clerics," he says. "They're so serious and po-faced. I like to think I'm above such sweaty and febrile concerns. But I am curious, you know. I like a good show. I want Jesus to dance for me. Do some tricks. Preach one of those charming little homilies that the peasants do like so much. They're so amusing, aren't they? Oh, come on, Jesus, play games. Play ball. Oh, I see you won't. Get rid of him." Herod, it seems to me, has that sort of supercilious, sneering attitude of those who like to portray themselves as able to rise above, a cut above the rest. Able to look down with a knowing eye and make cutting comments on the antics of other mere mortals and their petty concerns. Perhaps in another life he would have made a good sketch writer for some satirical Radio 4 programme. Or maybe write a newspaper column for an intellectual newspaper. Or perhaps he could write a very amusing opera. An opera that sneers at things that the little people are so foolish but think are important. And shows you how clever and cutting edge and that you are in breaking the boundaries. What about a good idea? Write an opera about Jesus that makes everyone laugh at him and show you how clever you are. I wonder if anybody else was going to think about that. Herod is a warning to all who are so self-satisfied as to think they can rise above the rest and look down and observe amusedly from their lofty tower at what is going on. And that doesn't just include the supercilious satirical types. It includes anyone who thinks they can act as a detached, disinterested third party, able to stand back and objectively evaluate Jesus from the vantage point of history or of academia or something like that. Jesus will not let anyone do that. And even by his silence towards Herod, he reveals the true character of the man. We are all involved. We are all sucked in, for or against, like it or not. Whatever Jesus says, whether he chooses to say nothing or everything to us, we are all drawn in. We are all on trial. So then, who killed the Messiah? In our study so far, we've seen Judas, we've seen Peter, we've seen scribe and Pharisee, we've seen Pilate, and we've seen Herod. We've seen such wonderful human qualities as greed and treachery, cowardice and weakness, hypocritical self-justification, calculating self-interest, and arrogant self-satisfaction. And there's more, too, in the story, isn't there? What about the mindless brutality of the soldiers? All in a day's work, might as well enjoy myself. Or the fickle mob mentality of the crowds, 1 minute praising him, a few days later hating him. Or the dying rage of the impenitent thief, the one who even in his last hours prefers to curse Jesus and die and go to hell than submit himself to him and call him his king. We could press on and explore more of these and mix together yet more shades in sin's dark spectrum and eventually produce the kind of deep, dark ugliness that together could murder a Messiah. And we could scan the faces in a Good Friday mob and see our own face looking on. We can read the clues in the murder mystery and find our own fingerprints all over it. Because we're all in it somewhere, justifying ourselves, preserving ourselves, satisfied with ourselves, indulging ourselves, disgracing ourselves, promoting ourselves, depreciating ourselves, pleasing ourselves, enriching ourselves, or whatever, but all ultimately implicating ourselves and condemning ourselves. Reading this murder mystery shows us that sin, even the most profound and wicked sin, is very, very ordinary, embarrassingly ordinary. The results of the Bible characters' actions were profound, but the people and their deeds were not profound. These were normal little people who, by some accident of history, managed to go on to murder the Messiah, rather than merely disappoint their parents or screw up their kids or diddle the VAT or whatever normal little people normally do. They just happen to have been dropped into the centre of history and find their sins on display for all. The rest of us are not so exposed. Sin is sold to us as cool and glamorous, original and virile and mysterious and all these things, but actually it's just pathetic and sad. Here is surely what you must say was the greatest, grandest crime. And what is there to impress us in these people who are responsible for it? Nothing at all. It's just a squalid, repellent little display, isn't it, to us with the retrospective of history. There are no Napoleons of crime, you see. No Napoleons of crime. There are just Daves and Steves and Brians and Jackies and Sharons and Carols and fill in your own ordinary sort of name in there. But just because it's also ordinary doesn't mean it's not awful, does it? We may think our petty little sins don't really matter because they look normal and small. We're all so familiar and comfortable with them and we can't really see what harm they ever do. But it's exactly the same things translated into subtly different contexts. Exactly those same petty little sins that start wars and kill children and ruin lives and murder messiahs. Exactly the same sins at a different place on the stage. Anyway, I don't think we're going to get much further into this mystery by examining the culprits anymore. There are a few more hidden depths to reveal, at least not those that will be helpful for our purposes. We have found murderous motivation aplenty. Who killed the Messiah? In our own ways, we all did. And that's an end to it, I suppose. The case is solved. Or is it? You know, I'm at that point in the mystery where Morse turns to Lewis, or Sherlock turns to Watson, or Marple turns to that dim-witted police officer, or whoever it is, and says, you know, something still is not quite right. Something still doesn't quite make sense. What about the victim himself? He's hardly the classic example of a murder victim, is he? He knows people are out to kill him, but he never fights, or objects, or tries to escape, or resist. At no point does he defend himself when he could preserve his life. In his trial, you get the impression that far more is exposed about his persecutors than it is about him. In fact, he clearly emerges the moral victor. And you get the impression that at any point, he could have changed the whole course of the action with just a word or two. It's almost as if he is there by his own choice. And that those who hate him are doing exactly what he expects them to do. Could it be then that there's one more figure to investigate in this murder mystery before we've really got to the bottom of it? Could it be that he played a role in it himself? If not suicide, at least a willing participation in what went on. That's a bizarre thought, isn't it? Yet you and I know this story all too well to be too surprised by it. For that's the conclusion we're going to get to next week. Strange things have happened in history. Great injustices have led to justice. The signing of the Magna Carta was an exercise in self-interest, intended to preserve the wealth and status of one set of crooks over and against another set of crooks. There was nothing particularly noble or good about it, yet in God's grace, that wicked self-interest became a vehicle for justice and freedom. And if strange things like that happen in British history, even stranger things happen in the gospel mystery. For God's grace is able to turn the injustice of the world's worst crime into the source of justice and freedom and forgiveness and liberation for all of us. And all because of the willing role played by the victim himself. So we turn next week to the final character in our murder mystery, the King on the Cross.